Get ready for the greatest roast of all time. The Roast of Tom Brady. A Netflix live event happening May 5th. Hosted by Kevin Hart. The seven-time world champion gets his cleats held to the fire by famous friends and frenemies on an unforgettable night where everything is fair game. Tune in on May 5th at 5 p.m. Pacific time for The Roast of Tom Brady. Live only on Netflix.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Everyone thinks I had a storybook career, that I just sprang into Disney Channel stardom overnight, made millions, and lived happily ever after. Spoiler alert, I didn't. There were countless failures along the way, and there still are. How I deal with that struggle and how I pivot when failure creeps in is what allows me to keep going, keep learning, and keep striving for balance. The Vulnerable Podcast is an invitation to hang out every week with me, Christy Carlson Romano, as I invite friends, celebrities, and experts for in-depth conversations discussing the good, the complicated, the beauty of being human, and what it means to be vulnerable. Join me every Tuesday as we navigate the ups and downs of my guests' paths to success.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.
Welcome to the Attacking Scrum podcast. The fallout from the Lions will begin here. A soul-destroying 2-1 defeat to South Africa, which means we've called in all the reinforcements. We've got Dan Killick, we've got the Mighty Murph, and we've got Justin George all with us. And yeah, I think it's going to need all four of us to get through this one. A very, very tough pill to swallow. And I know that because I feel like I swallowed the same pill 12 years ago. If you'd have said to me, Dan, in 2009, that in 12 years' time, we'd lose in similar circumstances and the same bloke would kick the winning penalty, you know, I simply wouldn't have believed you. Kicking the teeth out yesterday. What was your take on it?
Yeah, it was a really tough game, that one, wasn't it? Because I thought we played exceptionally well. It was the best performance, wasn't it? I thought we were far the better side anyway in that game. And for me, I know you don't like it when I say we deserve to win, but I just feel we played a lot of decent rugby, a lot of stuff there, and that's why I'm struggling today, and I've got a particularly flowery top on, because that's about the extent of the energy that I'm bringing tonight, really.
Mate, there's a lot of energy coming from that shirt. There's a real Stade Francais vibe going on there.
Yeah.
It looks like it should be like the Stade Francais leisure wear range.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah. 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 Your Sunday sort of casual
Murph,
part of the kit.
Murph, I know you're dealing with a double whammy of a painful defeat and the hangover today. Thoughts on the game?
Well, I've already been saying, I had a few yesterday, so it's quite hazy. But I remember being a lot of noise going around the clubhouse when Finn Russell had to come on. Like either people like me going, you know, here we go, let's see what happens, and a lot of people going, oh my God, what's going to happen now? So he made it interesting, I think. And I think he played well as well. But, yeah, I mean, overall, across the series, the three matches, like, it's hard to be... It's obviously, it's difficult to brand the brand of rugby they play. It's difficult to be excited about anyway. But I suppose if you're looking for something to compliment them on, it's probably the best defence I've ever seen from South Africa. They just are all completely on the same page at all times. There's no one caught napping and can't, you know, when they fly up and everyone's just getting blitzed. There's no one has not realised it's not, you know, and hasn't come up with them. Everyone is there, and so it makes it impossible to attack them off turnover and all the other scenarios you might want to attack from. So yeah, otherwise, like I said, and I said to all mates many times yesterday when I was half cut, that if they were playing out my garden, or better still, if they were playing out on our pitch, I would pull the curtains of the clubhouse.
Yeah, you sent that in the week, and that made me chuckle. I've been using that as my own, in the same way that you've been using it as your own, and it's a Bill Shankly quote, isn't it?
That's right. I mean, it gets used for all sorts of football teams and all sorts of people whose tactics are boring. But I've said it about Saracens loads of times. But that's all. I mean, you know, certain individuals there, Justin Colby, Diolende, the best in their position.
They are,
but. There's no ambition in that team, is there? I mean, it's just, even when Faf was injured, I thought, well, they might have to run him more if Kobus is there. But it was a bit, the only time they ever pass it to Cheslin is if it's from turnover, ball in the air. They don't plan to give it to him off first phase or phase ball at all. So, you know, good luck to him.
Like I say, it was a bit of pill to swallow, and one we're going to need a bit of cheering up from. So over to you, Yestin. This is your role, as always.
Yeah, I really loved it. It was great, wasn't it? It's really brilliant. It's so good to see Jack Conan making 3.5 yards before being smashed into pieces by men with broken... Mostert's face, man, live.
It was Mostert about 2 months ago. You said, who's that handsome devil who played for Gloucester, wasn't it? Oh, no, Snyman, yeah. Sorry, was it?
No, it was Mostert. When he first stood up at Gloucester, it was touch and go whether he looked more like a surfer than a rugby player.
Yeah.
But, it's, like I say, since he's been in Japan, his nose is further across his face now. I think he's had it straightened out yesterday.
He had it straightened out, but it's gone concave.
Yeah.
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 It looks like a, you know, like a giant slalom run there. It's horrendous.
Part of his nose is actually behind his eyes.
It was the redness after they'd wiped the blood away. There was a weird symmetrical redness around his face.
I think they put some sticking plaster, hadn't they? Like, that'll do.
I think so. The only thing behind the gain line for South Africa the whole game was his bloody nose, I think. That was it. Everything else was on the front foot. I was saying to Dan before you boys joined the call, I mean, like, obviously I said there in the intro that it's very similar to 2009. And obviously it is in terms of the result and the fact that Steyn kicked the winning penalty, but I really enjoyed that tour to 2009. It felt like a very important one in the Lions history. You know, after all the nonsense of 2005, it felt like a really good back to basics kind of re-engaging with the love of the Lions type stuff. This tour for me has actually, in a way, I think, been more damaging than 2005 was. I know the COVID stuff has had a lot to play, but it's been, I said to Dan, I've not enjoyed this one in the slightest. And it's not, I don't think it's just the style of rugby. It's the style of rugby, the lack of fans, the nonsense from Razzy Erasmus. I mean, there's always a bit of needle with the press and stuff, but this, just the whole atmosphere has been hideous from start to finish. And I'm honest, I'm kind of glad it's over now. I've really struggled to enjoy much of it, particularly once the tests began. But
I quite fancied after the first half, thinking, I remember I was just chatting to my son on the phone, and he was we were sort of saying it'd be quite nice if there were three halves of rugby, and then you kind of know the Lions would win after the first half that they had. And then within 5 minutes of the start of the second half, you were back in the depths of of every international team, even when Wales were losing, you know, getting roundly smacked, you know, by 20 or 30 points, you have your 10 or 15 minutes, don't you? Every team has it during the game. But the inability to wrestle the initiative from the Springboks was remarkable. But did anybody watch the New Zealand-Australia game?
I actually didn't know.
Well, good. I mean, four tries apiece. Tries apiece. But it was just too early for me, AKM.
Yeah, I mean, again, just to name check, Claire from Tonna, who's a kind of becoming a kind of silent partner in this podcast, she's been banging on about this for ages, and I just thought, okay, I'm gonna watch this Bledisloe Cup match just to see what it's, you know, what's going on. And it really was a remarkable contrast. And it wasn't because the rugby was particularly good. It wasn't fluent. There was tons of individual errors, and particularly in the first half. So both teams were not looking anything like their best, I would say, you know, 60-70% at very best. But what was amazing, there wasn't an injury throughout the game. There were hardly any, there were no water breaks, as or informal water breaks or otherwise. There was no TMO stuff. There was a try scored by New Zealand where they didn't bother going to the TMO, which would have been standard practice in the rugby that we watch on a regular basis. And it just made me think, not necessarily about, because, you know, I've been swapping texts with friends who are sort of saying, well, the box and all that kind of stuff. And I'm like, well, it's not that far away from Pro 14. You know, the kind of, I remember towards the end of the season, there was a Blues match, wasn't there, that went on for about 2.5 days. And it's just, it was really, watching New Zealand and Australia, it was about teams who were going to play rugby against each other. We're going to go, you score, we score a little bit, I guess. But at the same time, they just wanted to go out there and play rugby and then win. But it was a process, as every rugby cliche goes. The process was actually, let's just play some rugby. And I think that there was something seriously, seriously wrong with this series. But I don't think it's particularly, I don't think it's isolated to this series. I think it's much deeper than that. And it made me think, even the commentators in the New Zealand and Australia match weren't picking apart the referee's decisions all the time. They weren't thinking about all those things. And I just think we've got some mighty issues to deal with that are nothing to do with like the courage and the resilience and the skill and the fitness and all those things. Let's not knock the players for any of this, I think. You know, you couldn't fault Robbie Henshaw for running across and going and playing with his head up and trying desperately to cross the gain line, or for any of those players. You couldn't fault them, but you could definitely see that the culture was win at all costs and that the game suffered as a result.
That's really fascinating points in there. And I think that there's a couple of things I'd like to pick up on. One is the bigger problems. And I think just the needle in this series and the way that officials have been... And I know, obviously, we stick the boot into officials on here, right? As everyone does in the clubhouse and stuff. But I think that's one thing to say that, you know, that someone's got a decision wrong or they've had a bad game or whatever it might be. And God knows we see enough of that in the Pro 14. But the fact that they're getting it from water carriers, and the moment when that Springbok physio ran on the pitch as, I can't remember who it was, either Cowan Dickey or Wyn Jones or someone almost went over the line and ran into the dead ball area to shout at the ref. I'm like, I'm sorry, but that's, you should be sent to the stands for that. Whether you're a physio or not, you know, someone else you'll have to come from the stands every time there's an injury, because it's just getting ridiculous. And you know, again, all of this stems, or not stems from, but it's exacerbated by that rant from Erasmus in the lead up to it. And that's why I'm not too keen to bang on about the refereeing decisions this time around. It might, you know, I think sometimes you see that try given as a knock on where the ball pops in the air. Did it touch up? It doesn't really matter, because you're right. There are bigger things afoot here. And I think that the way that the players... And not even so much the players, but the the support staff and the coaches treat referees, you know, for a sport that bangs on about respect all the time. Like, we've got to kind of like stand up and think about it. And I think, like I say, I'm not, that's why I think this isn't the forum for us to kind of look at messed up refereeing decisions. It's just, I don't know, it feels like a big problem to me.
And there was some heated exchange between Neil Jenkins and Sia Khaleesi that I didn't actually spot.
I did see that, yeah.
And you just think, everybody's at it. It's not just, again, let's not just say, oh, well, it's the box. It's the box. It's not. You know,
and to be fair, I thought the referee handled it brilliantly. To be, you know, he told Jenks to get off at that point in time. He said it to the other South African physio at one point. He said, off the pitch if there's no one injured, you know. And there is just too much of that, that it's just getting ridiculous. And that's the point, is you just do need a little bit of a look in the mirror with, you know, all the things that that rugby tends to bang on about.
And the Colby try didn't need 47 replays of that, did it? You just take a view and get on with it, really.
Mm. Yeah. I mean, style of play, I mean, a lot of things you're highlighting there, yeah, you're right, that both sides are at fault, but style of play, you know, the Lions would like to play some rugby given the opportunity. If they weren't in a complete stranglehold at all times, they would like to play some rugby.
I'm not sure, Murph, to be honest. I think if you'd like to play rugby, I think they picked a side to match South Africa, really, you know, in kind of every department. And I don't know that we did, other than when Russell came on, who was the glimmer of entertainment throughout the entire Test series. I just think they could not deal with him in the first 10 minutes he's on the pitch. You're right, their defense has been outstanding the whole time, but it was the bit that led me back to 2009 more than anything, when they couldn't deal with O'Driscoll and Roberts in the centre. Just thought, actually, this could be something that reignites here. I just don't think the ambition was there. The game plan was, we are going to beat them at their own game. And that, I think, was always dangerous.
But the physio on the pitch thing, that's just another way of them slowing down the game, isn't it?
Yes, it is.
You know, and the Lions wanted more ball in play time, less hour-long halves, you know. So I think, although I don't disagree with any the point you're making about the Lions has been just as bad, I think the pace of the game is definitely, you know, South Africa is trying to drag that down at all times. And I'd go further than yesterday, actually. I think this series has put rugby union back seasons from where we were. Like, if you remember the Amazon Cup, it seems like a long time ago, but the Amazon Cup was just completely turgid, unwatchable tripe. Yeah. And whether they admit it or not, there was a reaction in the Six Nations because everyone tried, in some regard, even England, tried to play some rugby, and there was entertaining games and not always the highest quality. Some of them were, some of them weren't, but there was ambition on the pitch. Mm. And that's all gone down the toilet now in the last 6 weeks.
Dan Killick has sat there very, very pensive for the last 5 or 6 minutes. Dan, the series as a whole and the kind of the state of rugby and Lions, what's your take on it?
Yeah, some really interesting points in there from everyone. I did still enjoy the series, and I think I asked you off air, Jed, didn't I? Would you have preferred the series not to have gone ahead? And you know, you said you could probably have taken that. Yeah, as it not happening? But I wanted it to go. I'm glad that it went ahead. But it might be something to do with the times that we're in at the moment, that it's something to look forward to, for me anyway, on the weekends. But I did find it quite fascinating the way the Springboks were so, like you mentioned about the slowing down of the game, they'd analysed everything to the absolute nth degree, hadn't they, with every little facet, it was almost like a proper sort of like analytical scientific approach to how we can get this, how we can win this game, because they came into it, didn't they, from a really tough position. And it was just absolutely win at all costs, which you think it's always sort of going to be, isn't it? But they overstepped the mark, didn't they, really, with it in some of the stuff they did. But if you look at how they play, I mean, it's incredible, isn't it? They don't need They don't want possession. They don't want territory. They don't want anything other than just literally just squeeze the hell out of you. And it's very difficult, I think, to play. It's very difficult for the Lions to play, especially if you get really, if you get your set piece, you know, if you get your set piece wrong, and they back themselves on that front, don't they? But I think the big thing with that last test was the combinations. So there's not, Gatland's talked about it, isn't he? There's not much time to prepare. The midweek games were soft. So I think he tried to play some rugby. I think that was what they originally wanted to do. But they quickly worked out it was very, very difficult to do. And in that last test, you had combinations, didn't you? You had Ali Price and the magician at 10. And then obviously Van der Merwe on the wing. So it's 9-10 wing, which worked nicely. You had Bundiaki and Henshaw, the two centers that know what each other can do. Josh Adams, Liam, you know, Ken and Wynn. I think the fact that we got the combinations in there helped, but the games leading up to it were so soft that you couldn't really tell anything from those games. So then I think it made us go into a like play a game plan in the end that potentially, you know, didn't quite work for us. We could have done something else. In that last game, though, we brought in the inside ball, didn't we? I loved the way Finn was bringing, you know, he had an option inside, outside. And we started to suck him in then a little bit. We started to suck him in by bringing in the boys on the inside. But it was, I did still enjoy it. I enjoyed the sort of the matchup itself. But I agree with everyone that it has left. There's certainly some things that need to be looked at, don't they? In a pretty big way, really.
It was just the fact that, you know, the flow of the game is obviously, we've just already talked it, but when there are, like, it can't be just like some sort of magic coincidence that there were, you know, people were, Etzebeth was going down with the box and getting treatment. He still played 80 minutes, et cetera, et cetera. And, you know, you see Australia and New Zealand players, it's just about playing the game. You know, it isn't about, and that's with a lot of talk before the game of Australia going, we're going to marmalise the New Zealand scrum, which is a big claim to make. So that was a real point of attrition. So there's plenty of stuff going on in those games as well. You know, it's not as if they're Corinthian rugby players who are just patting each other on the back and saying, well done, everyone. It's still bloody hard. But there's something that we talked about identity last week, didn't we? And the fact that the Lions just didn't create any kind of sense of identity. And you've both touched on that kind of, well, in the end, they had to resort to this. And it's just, but I just don't think that's good enough anymore. Mm-hmm. I just think you're part of the entertainment industry, whether it sounds like an awful thing to say, but it is. And, you know, they can't just suddenly turn into the Harlequins overnight, you know, and they're playing against this team. But I just think there's a really bad, dark cloud of win at all costs, and it's too expensive to fail. And, you know, I take it back to regional rugby in Wales, where I just think there's a lack of expression, and it's too rigid, and we need to start having players who play with their heads up and go for it. And we have to change things.
Yeah, I mean, the style of play thing is interesting, because, again, I just think you look at that, and like Dan said, there were some combinations on the pitch yesterday, and perhaps that might have helped at points. But I just think we were lacking a bit of class in certain positions. And I think Ali Price worked really hard, and he did show some ambition and get, you know, the ball speed was much better in the first half. But it's a big ask for him to go from, you know, these tests that he's featured in have been by far and away the biggest games he's ever played in. And I think it's a big ask at nine in particular to, I think it's one thing playing on the wing and kind of, you know, making that step up at nine in a Lions test series against South Africa, where you've got to kind of, you've got to boss it. And he was the best out of the three on tour, but it was a big, big ask. I think you need, I said this a few weeks ago, you need a world-class nine to win a Lions tour. And Ali Price, you know, he might get there at some point in his career, but he wasn't quite there ready for this series. And likewise, you know, when Finn Russell looks up and he's got Henshaw and Aki outside him, who again are both international quality players. And I think there's just no creativity there, is there? You know, Henshaw is looking to do the creative bit in the centres. And Murph, you mentioned this weeks ago that we might struggle in the centre. And it's just that was it. You know, after a while, I think they figured out that as much as Russell added that level of enigma, there wasn't really much else there. There was no other footballers in the back line, really. You know, I mean, even Liam Williams, when the ball was kicked to him in the second half, he took the mark. You know, there wasn't that endeavour of 2017 where he's going to have a little run with it. You know, when we're trying to keep South Africa tired and keep the ball in play, even if he'd have just, you know, run and hoofed the ball back, that might have been something. But to take the mark, you just thought it's just slowing the game down. It's playing right into their hands. And that feels like it's, it's kind of come from the top down. So I think it's a few things. I think we were short on proper quality and proper options in a couple of positions. And that hindered any ambition whatsoever.
I can't help but think that he mentioned about ball in play. We're trying to keep the ball in play. And we looked dangerous, didn't we, when we had offloads and we had so few of them. But I keep on coming back to the back row. It just didn't work for me at any point. And the back row is so, so important. And, you know, if we look at Wales, for instance, when we get the offload in, the getting the boys in the wider channels and those sorts of things, that is something I think you can do with South Africa. That is, you can get on the outside, you can cause them issues. But we said we wanted to keep the ball in play. We didn't do it. And when you look at the side didn't back up what we said we wanted to do. For me, it was a bit like, hang on, I can't. Is that the side then to do that? Did you think that there's anything in that?
Well, it's difficult with the back row because you've been uncomfortable about it for weeks now, Dan, haven't you? It's just it's the blend, and there were lots of players. It might be worthwhile us thinking whose reputations were enhanced from this.
You mentioned him earlier, Justin. I actually think, and you know, I've been banging the Toby drum for, well, 5 years, but I thought Conan did a really good job. You know, I thought he was solid in the first two tests, but I actually thought yesterday he did at least try. You know, yeah, he got smashed a few times. There were some offloads and tried to use some footwork to get out of trouble. And I think that, you know, for a guy who only had 8 international caps, he handled himself very well against South Africa. I agree with Dan on the balance of the back row. Courtney Laws was probably maybe man of the series. I don't know if they've named that yet, but, you know, particularly on that first test. But there's something I just think that again plays into South Africa's hands, as brilliant as he was in the first test. That's their kind of back row. You know, I just think that by the time we'd come to the third test, trying something different and then having a bit more pace in there, either as a running option or trying to get to the breakdown with a couple of absolute fetches in there, I think would have helped. And I thought Curry was pretty quiet the whole time. You know, I think his best form, he's a lot more of a handful than that. He wasn't bad, but he was a 6-7 out of 10 in all three tests. And you need if you're going to play that back row, your 7 has got to win you ball after ball after ball and slow things down all the time. And it wasn't vintage, you know, it wasn't Curry's best form, I don't think. It certainly wasn't the form of 2019 in there.
And then if you go back to previous tours, and you've mentioned this, Jed, about going back to 97 and the fact is that Lions tours brought something extra out of players. And I don't think Adam Beard notwithstanding, and you know, I can't think of many players who came out of it being demonstrating an extra dimension or suddenly looking like a nailed on international player when you weren't quite sure before.
You're right. You even go back to 05 and, you know, the disaster that that tour was. But I remember coming away from that going, geez, Simon Easterby's got a big game in him. You know, and I'd always thought he was a good club player, maybe a solid international player. But you thought, blimey, he stepped up here to, you know, to put himself about. And actually, that was the point where I realised that Ryan Jones had something about him as well, you know, the performances he put in. But you're right, I'm not sure. I think Conan impressed me, but it's not on the same level as previous tours. And again, I don't know how much of that is down to the conditions that they're dealing with. It's a very, very weird tour. So I suppose we can't ignore that.
I don't blame the players for that. That's
no,
what
I don't. Yeah,
I don't think you can blame any of the players. It's up to the coaches to bring that level of extra performance out of people. So you just, you know, yes, you're right. The circumstances probably played a considerable part, but also, you know, that's why Ian McGeoghegan is so highly thought of, right? Because he gave the opportunity for players to elevate themselves beyond even international standard and go to a new place or something like that. And that is the magic of the Lions. And there was no evidence of that whatsoever.
Don't forget that they were the second choice coaches. The initial wave of coaches all pulled out. So, I mean, you know, if you want to, we're kicking lumps off this tour so much now. I'm trying to think of things from this tour, which is an improvement on 09. And the only thing I can think of, and it does stand out a mile now, is the number of people playing on in the 09 tour when they were clearly concussed, sometimes knocked out cold and getting up and carrying on. It looks gruesome now to see that. It's only 12 years, obviously, but you know, a decade, I suppose, is a long time in rugby union. But in your life, it's not that long ago. It looks absolutely weird to see Brian O'Driscoll knock senseless on the floor and get up and carry on playing. So, I mean, I suppose that is one thing we didn't get.
That second test is like Apocalypse Now, isn't it? Like, you look at it looks like a bloody war movie. Yeah. There's just like bodies everywhere.
High shots, willy-nilly. I remember the time thinking it was the most brutal, you know, series of games I'd ever seen. And it probably will stay in that way now because of the way concussion protocols have, I was going to say improved, but it's not improved because it didn't exist before. It had been brought in at all. So
I saw Josh Navidi kicking some grass at the end in his tracksuit and felt sorry for him. But I felt even more sorry for Gregor Townsend, I think, because he must have, as they keep on saying on the BBC pod, that he'd given it the big talk about this is going to be a new dimension of attacking play. And he must have been put back in his box or just recognised that it wasn't going to be possible.
But Townsend was one of the first choice this time round, wasn't he?
Yeah.
It was the others. It was Farrell and a couple of others. I can't remember who they were now. Farrell and Rantree and a few others who were the coaches who couldn't make it. And that's the thing I found puzzling the whole time was, if you want to play this kind of rugby, then, you know, you may as well not have an attack coach, you know, yet alone having Gregor there as someone who generally likes to play expansive rugby in a certain style. But yeah, it didn't, there are lots of things on the tour that didn't make sense. And that was just one of them for me. We're going to continue dissecting this in the second half. And we're also going to look generally at the future of the Lions and probably have a little dig deeper into some of those players who've enhanced their reputations or maybe taken a bit of a step backwards. So all of that is going to come up after this very quick break. Welcome to the second half of the Attacking Scrum podcast. The verdict, the post-mortem, if you like, of the Lions series. Dan, you've generally been trying to put a positive spin on this series, not just during this podcast, but kind of throughout. And you mentioned there, you know, that you've enjoyed having the series this summer. Do you think that, you know, if it hadn't have taken place and it had been next year, you know, potentially with crowds in and in a different an altogether different environment, that we would have had a different series? Or do you think that the box would have, you know, would have been strangled the life out of it anyway?
Still think they would have played a similar game plan, but yeah, when I was watching, I couldn't help but think just how brilliant it would be to see the fans, and then the impact that the fans have as well on, you know, just that general feeling. It's almost like everything. You realise that almost the whole thing is the fans, isn't it? Of course, it's the players, but it's the fans that make this. You know, you take the fans away, and it's just we've got something which, you know, I've still enjoyed it, probably because I sort of like the granular bits and bobs and the battles and the sort of weird stuff, but it's not a great spectacle, is it? You know, yesterday I mentioned it a number of times, Murph yourself, loads and loads of kids weren't interested in it, you know, just started going to play outside, doing anything but watching the game. And that's not really how it should be, should it? It should be the biggest sporting, you know, one of the biggest sporting rugby events, really, and inspiring a load of people. But it just wasn't there, really, was it?
I think I might have been one of those kids who lost interest yesterday, because you three have already mentioned at least two things that I can't remember from the game yesterday.
I hope to God those kids weren't as pissed as you were. That's all I'll say. That's why you can't remember them. Yeah. You've said it, Murph. Like Dan said it there, that, you know, the Lions is something that should, you know, inspire audiences to watch, and perhaps, you know, a more casual rugby fan in there. Yestin said that it's the entertainment industry, and, you know, and you should be, the Lions is one of those occasions. And, you know, and you've said yourself that if they were playing at the bottom of your garden, you'd close the curtains. And I think there is something, you know, if a bunch of nauseas like us are struggling to find much enjoyment out of it, there is something that is a bit of a concern in there. And I'm not, you know, like I say, you're not expecting them to chuck the ball around like the Barbarians, but I think just that lack of any real tangible exciting back play, or, you know, what I'd consider rugby to happen, I do think is perhaps something to consider for future tours.
Would we be less peeved if the Lions had managed to scrape another win like they did in the first test, though? Say if they, I mean, because yes, they could almost have gone either way. I mean, the Lions turned down a couple of kicks at goal and things to try and obviously impose themselves at the driving maul and what have you. And so, it's not impossible to imagine the game could have been won by a point or two by the Lions. And if we'd been sat here out of the 2-1 win, you know, any kind of series win is quite momentous, whatever the circumstances. But I don't think it would, we still would have been sat here saying we hadn't seen any rugby. Mm. But if they managed to scrape, would it have vindicated the Lions' tactics? I don't know. Either way, it still would have set the sport back a few seasons. But
I think in the context of the way the series was set out, oddly, it would have been completely vindicated, because ultimately,
well, of course, because that's all they went for. But yeah, I just Gatland, mean from our point of view, would we be less cheesed off now if we had scraped through?
I think we'd be less cheesed off, but we wouldn't be sat here, you know, as we would have in 1997.
They wouldn't be writing books about it in 4 decades' time, that's for sure.
No, but the interesting thing is there's a lot of stuff in the papers about this being, you know, the death toll for the Lions, and that happens from time to time. I said it, you know, it happened in 05, and luckily we got to a position, you know, it happened when professional rugby was invented. They said this, you know, this thing will never kind of continue. I think it will, but I just think next time round is a really, really important tour, and will need to be something that can kind of capture a bit of imagination, because there was very, rugby will have won no new fans off the back of this.
No.
Well, somebody said, I think I must have heard it on the radio, and they said, does that ask any... somebody asked Gatland whether he'd be up for leading 2025. And I'm just like, as if, almost as if it's his job to turn down. It's like, forget about it. I mean, surely the, I'm not saying this from a, you know, I'm not, I've never enjoyed, obviously as a Welshman, never enjoyed people just pouring their scorn on Gatland and along the years, even if I wasn't his biggest fan from time to time. It wasn't, I think, you know, he'll always go down in history with us as somebody who helped the Welsh cause enormously, right? And brought some great pleasure, but his legacy will be this, won't it? And it's just, I think it's unfortunate, you know, and I'm not saying it's his fault and you live by the sword, die by the sword and all that, but it's just a shame, because we would have said, even if he'd have manufactured a spawny victory yesterday, well, it wouldn't have been spawny, but it would have, you know, like you said, it could have gone either way. But it still doesn't leave a good taste in the mouth. And I think, unfortunately, now Gatland will be remembered for this more than in Britain anyway, and Britain and Ireland. And the Irish have always hated him anyway. So
well, they have, yeah, that's a good point.
So I think he'd be, I think it's a shame. It's a shame because they, you know, nobody's not working hard, but I just think that they're working hard for the wrong aims, which is just literally, you know, driving a victory by whichever means necessary, and just being pragmatic to the point of losing sight of why we all love this game, you know.
Yeah, going back to the style of play and Gregor Townsend and whether he was put in his box or where have you, I think early on, well, you've credited me with calling it, the centre was an issue, but I think early on it was clear that there's no midfield magician in the British Isles. There's no one who's going to, you know, I don't want to bring up old names, cliched names from the past, but there's no one who's going to do sleight of hand and cut anyone wide open. So then, like, the other option then is to overpower him in midfield. And then during May, April, May, you've lost Tuilagi in this country. I mean, you've lost George North, because George North could have, you know, punched some quite big holes in this tour if he toured. And then that becomes different, because if you win in the midfield collisions, which they never did, they might have had some half-tidy carries now and again, but on the whole, they didn't win midfield because, you know, they had quality. Well, as I said, they got a quality defence. But if you did have that kind of two-pronged beast of attack in Tuilagi and North, then you're over the gain line. And then when you give it to your half-backs over the gain line with possibly some speed on the ball, then things are different. But I think it became obvious to them, maybe, I'm guessing, that there was no magician and there was no way they were going to overpower D'Alende and to a lesser extent Am. And maybe that's why they went the pragmatic route, just mash him up, try and match him up front and go from there, kind of thing. But it was like you say about the scrum halves, I think you were talking about last week when I couldn't come on, 4 years ago was Conor Murray in his prime and Rhys Webb on the bench, which, you know, obviously he's past his best now, Rhys Webb, but I think Rhys Webb at that time, it'd be better option than both of the nines that they got available in the squad this time round.
Comfortably.
Just because, you know, he just attracts defenders and, you know, he doesn't have to make much breaks. He just draws people to him and puts people away, that kind of thing. So, yeah, their attacking options just kind of dried up. If you couldn't get quick ball to the big wingers or to Anthony Watson, which South Africa had decided you weren't going to, there wasn't any, I don't think there was any real other way to go.
Yeah, that's a good points there, Murph. Delande, he was spectacular, wasn't he? All tour, you've been raving about him, I know, for a year, but he carries better than an eight, doesn't he, as well, when he does get the ball. And Am is, he's got a real classy touch about him, isn't he? He tends to do something in the game, which is which just changes the game really. And it looks kind of just basic, but it's he's a pretty special player. I'm beginning to think now.
Yeah, I think, correct me if I'm wrong, when those balls spilled into the in the air from the eventual Kobe try, it was spilled into Am's hands, and I think he was the one who recognised what was on and quickly gave it to Cheslin, which is something you would no one in the South Africa side normally.
I think it's Am to LaRue, wasn't it?
LaRue,
yeah. LaRue went in from there. Yeah,
but Am had the nous to recognise what was on.
Yeah,
and that was that. Going back to what Dan was talking about earlier about the sort of pragmatism in South Africa, the one thing with that I'll never forget. I'll wake up in the middle of the night, is that kick, doesn't matter who was playing, whether it was Pollard or LaRue, that kick that really just went across the field and was a 50-50, which yet again they benefited from yesterday, is the ultimate sign of their pragmatic approach, isn't it? You know, it's not even an up and under, it's not even 20 yards. It's not 20 yards down the field. It's literally just like, here we go, bang, there you go. Let's see what happens here.
Yeah, it's like a kind of a reverse, you know, 1980s Ireland, and like 99% of the game was kick chase.
Yeah.
Kick shit out of it and then batter anyone who tries to pick it up. That was like Ireland's style of rugby in the 80s.
So Gary
Owen. They did have some quality in Brendan McMullen now and again, but he would rarely get the chance because he was always a bit like Cheslin Kobe. He was always chasing kicks. And this is an element of not downfield and then kick.
No, it's across the field.
Just make everything 50-50 and benefits, because their prime ball for attacking from is spilt aerial ball. That's what they attack from. They don't do any launch plays from first phase or any, as we know, any phase play at all. They would try to get someone to drop the ball from a high ball, and that would be their launch from there of attack it through the hands. So. Yeah, it's got elements of 1983 Ireland.
And there's no it's bigger
extremely
compliment
difficult
than that,
to play against.
Yeah. It's a ringing endorsement. Weirdly, lots of, like, even though that's a lot of the time that was the tactic, there's still lots of romantic names attached to that side, like Keenan Fitzgerald and Jerry McLaughlin.
Trevor Ward.
Ringland. I used to love Trevor Ringland.
I didn't like Ollie Campbell, but I love Tony Ward.
I think Trevor Ringland always used to have his sock ties flaring out to the side. He'd leave them hanging off. So it'd be like these ribbons coming off his legs as he was running.
I think Brendan Mullins had a muck added to his name there, Murph, as well. Which
Did I call him McMullen?
Yeah. So anyone playing the Murph drinking game, that's one finger for a muck, for an added muck.
Well, I think, unless I'm mistaken, last podcast of the season, it's just, well, down it at this stage. That's what I did yesterday.
Taking your own advice, yeah. Exactly.
Yeah. I was going to say, yeah, straight out of the Murph playbook. That one.
Oh,
yeah.
Just thinking about it makes you feel queasy.
But that's how I feel about this whole tour.
without going through from 1 to 15 with sort of the grimness of who are the players you think that have emerged from it? From
Wyn Jones.
Agreed.
Well, yeah.
I think we all knew that as well, actually, how important he was. Again, you know, I think all Wales fans knew that.
But he didn't because of injury, didn't actually get a chance until the last test, and, you know, so he didn't really get to impose himself on the series properly. But I don't disagree, but he didn't get a full run at it, did he? I don't know. I mean, Ali Price, I suppose, has emerged as one of the, because of this tour, one of the best nines in the British Isles, but I probably wouldn't have had him at that on that level beforehand, but do have Van der Merwe. A lot of people, especially outside Scotland, wouldn't have been, or outside the Pro 14 or whatever we call our league, wouldn't have been too aware of him until this tour. But there's not many. But a lot of just reinforced, like Marawa Toje, people are just reinforcing what they already had, really.
I thought Henshaw went as well as he... I thought he played pretty well, considering...
I think Henshaw in another tour, you know, would have really enhanced his reputation, if you see what I mean, with with an O'Driscoll next year. I know that's easy to say because the guy was class, but, you know, with some real class either inside or outside of him that could have bought something else out of him.
I think he was the only constant, really, as well, wasn't he? He was trying to... it was very, very difficult for him playing against the... the masters of manipulation.
Yeah, and I think that's it, actually, is going up against those two, which is the best centre combination in the world. I think that, you know, if you come out of that with your reputation enhanced, then fair play. I mean, something we haven't mentioned, and obviously, you know, a lot of us were kind of clambering for Liam Williams to get back in the side. And I really thought he was going to have one of those games because he is a big game player. And when he took that catch above his head like a goalkeeper, I thought, right, we're in actually. He's going to nullify things a bit here. And it's just so, you know, look, he knew the minute after, the second after it happened, that he should have given it. We all know it. It's been highlighted afterwards, so I don't want to go on about it. But you just think those moments are so, so big in Test match series. And unfortunately, we're going to have to look back at that one for kind of years to come as something that could have changed the outcome of the series.
There's two that he's getting flack for, isn't there? There's the pass he didn't give, and the step. I mean, the step from Colby. I mean,
I think
who hasn't been stepped by Colby?
Yeah,
that was, he was coming from the other side, wasn't he? That was very, very difficult tackle. That wasn't. The hooker.
Cowan Dickie made a better, easier. Yeah,
better just, attempts. Yeah.
Yeah,
there's no disgrace in getting stepped or offended by Colby because the guy's pure class.
I know it sounds like hyperbole, but even when you're watching in slow motion, it's hard to see it coming.
Yeah,
it's just something freakish about the way, because it's goose step, then like a delayed land on his right foot, and then he explodes to the left. Do you know what I mean? So even when you watch it again, it's like you still can't imagine how anyone's going to read it when you see it. Over and over, if you know what I mean.
Yeah, he somehow doesn't slow down with it, does he? Most players, when they do it, actually.
Well, he gets
slow
quicker
down.
Off it. When he hits off that right foot, it goes quicker in the other direction. So it's.
Yeah. And that in itself is kind of that whole theme of the tour that, you know, we actually have got a guy here who's really special, once in a generation kind of player.
Yeah.
And we're only seeing him off, not even turnover ball, off spilt aerial ball.
He's a kick chaser most of the time in that side. I mean, he must be delighted when he goes back to French rugby, because they use him over there, you know. Just briefly going back to players who've enhanced their reputation, I think Tadhg Furlong, he's had an injury-disrupted few seasons, and I think on this tour, he's gone back to that level where it's him and then the rest of the tight ends in the British Isles, because he's head and shoulders. I mean, he can scrimmage and he can just do everything. Hasn't he got some nickname, like something potato?
I thought the jukebox is the one I heard, because the hits keep on coming.
Oh, right. Okay. Yeah. I know I saw him. He's been doing DJing classes, haven't they, on the tour with Josh Navidi and what have you. But there's some nickname about his features and his general build. He looks like a big potato anyway.
Yeah. I imagine getting hit by him must be getting hit by a phone box.
Yeah.
Definitely. He would have been. It's a big act to follow then. So Sinclair was getting beef yesterday for coming on and it wasn't, and yada, yada, yada. But I think that's, you know, giving Jed the open, passing the ball over you for a tap in. But I think it's just following a player of that quality into, and they were, by that point, the South Africans were completely in control of the game. So it was just like a massive ask. That's why I never thought, in a way, it was a relief that Finn got on early rather than that ridiculous hospital pass of going, okay, we're 10 points behind, with 20 minutes to go.
Yeah.
Go on, Finn, do your stuff. It's like that. Yeah. I hated that when people were talking about that. It was like, what?
Well, I agree 100%, but... As it turned out, the way they struggled to play against him when he first came on, if that had been in the last 15, 20 minutes when there was more fatigue on the pitch, it might have been more of a benefit to the Lions, if you know what I mean.
Mm.
When he was, they eventually worked him out.
But the thing was, the Lions had the upper hand at that stage when Finn had the ball, so he was able to do that. Whereas if you'd have come on in the second half when the South Africans were in total control, it was
good
all,
point. Yeah,
it,
yeah,
it wouldn't have.
You would have had no service. Yeah, you're right. But
and it just seems that's where everybody might be dissing the substitutes and saying why did Alan Wynn go off, or why did this and blah blah blah. It's like they had nothing to do with the outcome of the game, I don't think.
Yeah.
No, it would have been interesting to see Finn Russell with, you know, this as the game went, the set piece started to creak, didn't it? And that, you know, potentially was, yeah, the time when, you know, Finn might have opened up, you know, opened up something. He looked so, I know he looks supremely confident anyway, doesn't he? But I wonder whether, you know, the players he was playing around, because he looks, you know, he looks mercurial, doesn't he, in most sides he plays. But there was, I know we've talked about the centre partnership, you know, could have been stronger and the other combinations, but there is some absolute quality around him as well. And he looked like the king out there, didn't he? He looked great. He almost didn't put a foot wrong, did he?
Well, I mean, even the goal kick in as well, which, yeah. Again, I'd said before the tour when Murph was, you know, talking about, you know, well, do you start Finn Russell at 10? And my major concern was, you know, are you going to have him goal kicking? I think it was mentioned in the commentary that, you know, he's third choice goal kicker at Racing. But they're all pressure kicks. And, you know, and Dan Bigger, as I've said, is, you know, is the player, probably the player in the world I'd want to take those kicks. And he missed a couple that by his standards in the test series, he would have been disappointed with.
And so did Pollard.
Yeah. And so you think all it takes is one of those, you know, a slight mess up in your rhythm, or the nerves getting to you to slightly skew one of those. And his kicking was fantastic. You know, he looked really, really calm and composed. And I don't think he was just trying to run everything. I just think he had a really good balance to his game yesterday. So, you know, to go back to that point of players who've enhanced their reputation, I think he has. We all know that he's got the ability to tear sides apart on his day. But I think the balance of game management and ambition shows that there is a player there who can cut it with the best of them.
Okay, I was just going to briefly say that last autumn, Finn was the prime 10 in this neck of the woods. He was in his best form, and then he had a flat Six Nations, and that's why he ended up as kind of third choice 10 on the tour as such. But if he'd kept his autumn form right the way through to this tour, I think they would have been forced to start him in the series.
Yeah, well, I mean, even if he'd have stayed fit on the tour, you know,
he didn't get much game time. Yeah.
No, he didn't, and I think that, that was a real shame because, just featuring somewhere in the match day 23, I think he's just that element of something different that we didn't have anywhere else in the backs really, it's a shame that it's kind of come right at the end, but it was that glimmer of hope really.
I was just saying there that I got quite frustrated in the sort of 15, 20 minutes to go with the way the South Africa, I felt, weren't, I don't want to, you know, mention the ref, but I'm going to mention the ref, didn't pick up on the fact that they were deliberately, like, you know, deliberately slowing the ball up, but in an illegal way, time and time again. And it was just so frustrating that for me, there had to be a card. And, you know, there was a few cards that were missed throughout the game, but not mentioning those, but at key parts, there was almost like this manipulation of the whole, like, the whole sort of, you know, breakdown and everything that was going about it. And then it was almost like they got into our heads as well on what we were going to do when we did get a pen. I was beginning to think there was like something going on. It was, yeah, I don't know whether anybody else had thought along those lines, but I was like, just screaming, you know?
Yeah, well, because of the off-field politics and the circus around this tour, a yellow card would have felt controversial. From any ref at any time,
and I think to either side as well. I personally thought Finn Russell's was a yellow. I know that he slipped, but he made contact with the head. I think the mitigating was from red to yellow. Personally,
it was a yellow, wasn't it? Yeah,
at least a yellow, at least bare minimum yellow. I thought, but
yeah,
everything felt like a diplomatic incident when the referee had to make his mind up.
But I mean, what do you expect when you've got that that performance from Erasmus the week?
That's what he's done to the sport.
And this is it. It's like World Rugby have the opportunity. They've spoken the words that it's going to be looked into and will be acted upon. There needs to be some seriously big action off the back of it, because otherwise he'll carry on doing it. And, you know, I imagine he's going to start, even if he leaves his role as director of rugby with South Africa, he's going to carry on doing this regardless. Like, he's going to turn into the Donald Trump of rugby. And we're just going to have to deal with, this bullshit the whole time. And
it makes Eddie Jones look quite tame. That's one.
Honestly, it makes you desperate for Eddie Jones. You know what I mean? It's
like, I won't go that far.
Jed, how would you market Razzie Erasmus?
Yeah, Dan, you've just got to fully embrace it, haven't you? You've just got to fully embrace it and just go, you know, it's the brash, divisive world that we live in that works. Yeah, that works. It does, though, doesn't it? You know, we're getting very deep now, but you live into a world, you know, you live in a world where, you know, division on social media drives views, and, you know, Facebook and Twitter rewards. The more arguments there are, the more people will see stuff. So is it any real surprise that filters into rugby? And that's, you know, that's not just from senior figures on sides. You go on Twitter after any match, and I know Murph loves sitting there like watching a pub fight. Yeah, yeah. Doom scrolling. Yeah.
I love it.
And you know, I've just got to take myself out of that environment, because I find it so depressing. And then, but that feeds it, you know, that's fed into right at the top of the game. But World Rugby has an opportunity to stamp this out. And if they don't do it, then they've completely bottled it.
I would suggest that World Rugby have got a whole, there's a lot of plates suddenly going to their door with needing issues to deal with. I think there's a whole ton of not, and that's obviously that's a disciplinary issue. But I think that there's a ton of stuff. You know, you can take all the kickoffs from your own line as that you want in the next, you know, and all these kind of trialing new rules that they're doing at the moment. But there's a ton of stuff to just make the one hemisphere's game the same as the other hemisphere in terms of the way that it's managed and refereed. And that, again, not having to go at the refs, just saying that, you know, those same refs are going to referee games that are going to 90 minutes, you know, next season. I bet you any money, the way that it's going, Six Nations, Pro 14, you know, the Prem, all of those, everything needs looking at properly, definitely.
It is frustrating as well, because I feel like we had this big, almost like an axe to grind after the Amazon Cup, that, you know, rugby was kind of rotting at its core in terms of the lack of ambition. And then we did see in the spring, particularly in club rugby, you know, you saw a lot more, you know, Six Nations helped, but then also in club rugby culminating in that English Premiership final, you know, you saw that rugby can be a truly amazing and beautiful and exciting game. And yeah, like Murph said a number of times, this has set the sport back from style of rugby through to the on and off field antics. That it's just shone the sport in a really bad light. And this is your ultimate shop window, isn't it? Is the Lions Tour, in a way, even more so than the World Cup.
This sounds like so bitter, but you've got everything should be coordinated to ensure that the Springboks can't win the next World Cup. It should be like every new rule should be like, does that mean that the Springboks won't win? Yes, it does. Okay, fine, let's go.
Yeah, you can only have a certain number of players with Van or De in their surnames playing on the pitch at any one time.
Too many 6'8" players who are really athletic. There's a cap on bomb squads.
Yeah.
There's all sorts of things. I reckon we could draw up a whole list of things now, and we could make sure they don't.
I think there's a serious point in there about how, for example, the All Blacks are going to develop their game now in the next year or so, because they've always got a response. They, you know, they will always be a step ahead of us up here. They, it's just something they do. They just come up with a new way of generating quick ball and using it better. And I mean, the you alluded to the Bledisloe Cup game, but also the France Australia series that was played. That was, I mean, it was like France third choice in a lot of cases, but it was still, you know, a lot of rugby being played and what have you. And the trouble is, when those teams butt up against this defense, South African defense, what are they going to do then? You know, like South Africa are coming up here in the autumn, and I am not paying for a ticket to that game.
I hope someone smashes
them. Although I don't know who else they're playing.
But the thing is,
Murph, you can buy mine off me.
I bet you've got one already. Yeah.
Mate, you said have before buy. There, you're gonna have to take your first answer there. I think Murph would say you'd have to pay him to go and watch it now. But
that's true.
The thing with that is, though, is I just think you saw in even for a brief 10-minute period during that game when Finn Russell first came on, is they went, oh, what the hell is this? Like, there's a geezer running and passing against us. And, you know, France have the quality from 9 to 15 and in the forwards to play some rugby that I think will trouble them. New Zealand always will. I think that if you go back to... I mean, New Zealand beat them at the last World Cup. So I think when you... I don't think that it's necessarily a given that they're going to be able to dominate everyone from...
No, I'm not getting that at all. I don't think they will. I don't think they've got the resources. I mean, they were threadbare on this tour. You know, they had Snyman missing and different people missing. But I just mean, when it comes down to an important game where they want to win, are they just going to be able to shut everyone in the world down when they want to with this style? Or, because I mean, some of it, if they are able to do this when they, you know, in a really key match they really want to win, It goes back to Yesin's point that they will have to change the rules, because you can't. What good is it to the sport?
Well, that's a good point.
They are bringing in things to, you know, to speed things up and you know, cut down on the number of set pieces if they can, and different things. It's happening now, actually, in community level. They got the 50-22 coming in and different stuff happening. But it's a little bit like the early 90s trap of England just dominating everyone up front and then winning the Grand Slams.
It is. But again, England were miles ahead in terms of fitness levels and other stuff. It wasn't just, you know, and you think what a mess Wales were at the time and everything else. But the thing is, I think if you look at that South Africa side, yes, you know, you cannot argue with a World Cup win, but they did lose to New Zealand during that during that game. They beat, and in the big games, I think what you've got to credit them with is the mentality. And we said it's win at all costs, but they don't seem to feel the pressure and have this ability to grind out the games. But I just think when they're up against a side who can really, really play, in a way, like, they'd have found it harder to play Australia in that World Cup final than they would have England, because England were never going to come and play. You know, Wales, obviously, in the semis, we say scrape past, but they were the better side in that. But Wales weren't going to come and play at them.
We had so many injuries. We didn't have any options.
Yeah, so I think France, Australia, New Zealand are all sides who can give them maybe even Argentina on their day could give them a real headache.
Well, Argentina are playing them next week, but I'm sure that they'll be playing a third string box team. But the other thing to say is that most of them are all in ticking around the 30 mark as well. So I think that's one of the really big things about the game and the victory. I think that it was the icing on the cake for them after the World Cup. Then they've beaten the Lions, and I don't think a lot of those players are going to be around for very much longer.
Mornie Steyn's targeting the tour in 12 years' time, I think. they'll just wheel him on to take the winning kick.
Weirdly, I was fully behind them at the World Cup, because they'd actually been in possibly the worst form that country has ever shown. You know, there might have been another period, but you know, the 12 months running up to the World before Reds Erasmus took over, they were shocking. I mean, they were really poor, and to turn them around so quickly into this side was impressive. And then you had, you know, they had the Sia Khaleesi effect and all the other different things going on. But now, you know, obviously they haven't played in between then and now, but now they're still doing the same thing. and it's bloody boring.
Yeah. Well, I mean, this is it. It'll be interesting to see, like Yestin says, that now they've got to rebuild. And you know, maybe there's an evolution of style that will follow. I mean, to use the common rugby parlance, the shithousery will be there regardless. Like, you know, you can always rely on South Africa to be the most gnarly, underhand, dirty bastards, and take pride in it as well. You know, I think every single one of them is like our sport, you know. And I don't know, maybe that's right, maybe it's wrong, but it's...
Yeah, well, it's another thing that stands out from the 09 tour, aside from the people playing with concussion, is the amount of cheap shots and off the ball stuff you can't do anymore. You just can't do it anymore. You will, well, so long as you haven't got a French TV director or a South African TV director, you don't get away with stuff like that anymore.
Yeah, so. Reason 157 of stuff that I hated from this tour.
Yeah.
The selective replays from the host broadcast.
Two available at all times, even though there's 14 cameras.
Just disgraceful. Like I said, at certain points, it was like the spirit of those biased 70s tours was still alive there. You know,
well, once I'd had a fair amount of lubrication yesterday, I was with some officials from my club and Cardiff Met. I was holding court about, you know how there's independent doctors now that decide on HIAs because of the risk of the native doctor saying, oh, no, he's fine, and pushing him back out. Well, if it goes on like this, I think there was more than a few incidents on this tour where there were issues weren't looked at, either because they weren't made available or the, you know, TMO or whatever, but footage is not being made available at times, and it's already been pointed out that it happens in France. If you want a completely fair match, will you have to have an independent TV director sat in the van? Pointing out, hang on, could you see this angle? You could share that angle, and then you know, the native TV director telling him to get stuffed. And,
somebody who normally does Love Island or something. drafted in to go.
Yes, then you've gone for a much more contemporary reference. I was going to say Andy Townsend is digging out the tactics truck, been parked on his drive in Bexley since ITV had the Premiership rights. I thought, get him sat there in the truck, pouring over the decisions.
And just to go back and just bore on endlessly about New Zealand versus Australia, they had a New Zealand referee in the Bledisloe Cup match, and nobody asked any questions.
Is that because they wouldn't allow anyone else to fly into the country?
Yeah,
I'm guessing, because they're playing the same venue next week, aren't they? So
right, okay,
it's not as... They're not swapping venues or going.
Anyway, I laboured the point here and in the bar that that position of the TV director is now holding influence over matches.
Important
matches are being influenced by TV directors.
And that's the thing, actually, is I do think, like, as much as made about how shambolic it is to have a South African TMO, I don't think that the situation is shambolic. It's not a slight on the individual. Because I don't think I don't think he would have seen things as biased. And as I say, in the first test, South Africa had to rub the green when it came to the big TMO decisions. But the fact that we're not seeing those decisions at home, like, you know, there was a definite high shot on Connor. I think it was on Connor Murray in the second test that has just not been seen anywhere. it's like the rest.
It was Faf de Klerk.
It was like
they showed him from behind, so you couldn't see which part of his face was smashed by his arm.
They said it was low, perfectly fine tackle. Well, waist.
Low. That was his name, was it? Francois.
Further argument to that is that the TV director, even if he wasn't naturally biased by being from that country, it's in his interest, because if he's from the native broadcaster, the home side winning and playing well means business for his, it means advertising for his employers, it means everything. It is his job. It makes his, like, you know, like the thing about BT Sport controlling the narrative, and that is part of, you know, generating interest and making their money back, if you like. And that is why the TV director is whether even if he was from Argentina or Chile, he's going to be biased because it makes his job better if he doesn't dob in his home team.
Just you wait till BBC lose the Six Nations rights and it goes to Andrew Neil's GM News or GB News or whatever it is.
Yeah, yeah.
And that's it. We're blaming all the high shots on immigrants.
Yeah, deep fake images of a inflatable boat smashing into Owen Farrell's face or something. Yeah. But I over-egged that point yesterday, and I still think I got a solid argument.
But I'll over-egg my point and say that it just wasn't part and parcel it doesn't need to be part and parcel of the game. You know, it just shouldn't be there. That's not the reason that why everybody plays rugby. So stop it.
You know, to go back to your point about it being the entertainment industry, and it's often banged on about that, you know, how important money is in the game and the commercial side of things, right? And it does need to exist, but you're not winning any friends with the way the TMO is used right now. And again, the only people you hear championing the TMO, the occasional football fan on Five Live who doesn't watch any rugby, who says, oh, they use it in rugby, but it's fine. And it's like, no, it's not. Because if you've watched it for the last 10 years, it's been getting progressively worse. Like, you've just got to decide, what do you want it to do, right? Serious foul play, yes. You know, that's fine, because that's in the interest of keeping players safe. You know, a fractional foot, like yesterday, right? They poured over it for a long time. Might have been forward, might not have been, but they're the decisions that just, I think, should go with the on-field decision.
Would we all get rid of it if we could right now?
No,
would you do?
No, I wouldn't get rid of it.
I think it's been good in the past myself. It's just
they need to act with a certain power in silence in the background. So I like it when they go check, check, and then it's like, okay, rather than go, okay, every decision we're gonna choose. The other thing is, sorry, Nige, it's not right. You gotta get rid of that. That is not right. It's just not right.
And that's more pressure.
Have a referee refereeing the referee in a rugby commentary.
I'd
go further. I'd have someone. I'd have a commentator refereeing Nigel refereeing the referee, and it could go on forever.
Yeah,
I'd have a commentator. Yeah, and an analysis.
So wrong.
He's naturally
going well.
Defend.
I can see. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, but at the same time, he's going to go, I can see his point of view, but, and then they start going, what about putting in crooked to scrums? What's that all about? And I'm like, commentate on the game, for crying out loud.
Yeah. You're right. He could be a pundit before and after the match, but during the game, it's just a distraction. Yeah.
It's not right. No. It's not right.
Oh, well.
Agreed.
Look, boys, it's been an emotional one. Not always the right emotions, but that's rugby, and that's it for the season. So it's been a bloody long one as well.
Let's just quickly troll through our team of the season, and then we'll pack it in.
We'll troll through the team of the season individually, by competition,
and argue like fuck over each position
for the next
15,
for the next
Matthew Morgan.
Yeah, right. I'm playing in 10. Come on.
Oh yeah, Dan Fish is playing 15.
Fish is playing 15, and Dan Killick,
the fish.
Dan Killick slid Lloyd Williams in at 9, and Owen Farrell at 12.
Yeah,
a big thank you for all your contributions throughout this year to Dan, to Yestin, to Murph, to all the other co-presenters we've had on, to everyone who's done who did the Dream 15s with us when we had all the first lockdown. If you want to go back and have a listen to them, they're still available for you. Big thanks as always to our sponsors at So Coffee Trades. If you want to get your hands on some good quality coffee, be sure to do that at socoffeetrades.co.uk. Obviously, Scott Otten, the owner of that business and the former Ospreys hook, had to retire this season. So, if you want to get behind a great young Welsh company and see some of the great stuff Scott's doing, then make sure you go and do that. But that is us for this season. We'll be back after a bit of a break, and we'll be back with a newly revamped United, what are we calling it? United Rugby Championship, I think.
So we still haven't had any dates for it, by the way.
Haven't we?
No, it's an issue, because unless I'm mistaken, there's an issue with South African teams coming here.
Yeah, Yeston's banned it from happening.
Yeah, yeah. Unless they promise to play like
that's the grand plan. If it wasn't for you pesky kids, I would have got away with it.
I know. This is it. Like, yeah, all the talk with South Africa potentially joining the Six Nations, you know, it's like you can forget about that. Like,
yeah, we'll have Georgia, thanks.
Yeah. Asadi wants to play a bit of rugby. Let's have Georgia in there.
Yeah.
Yeah. So all of that to look forward to. When, who knows, we probably won't even be called the attacking scrum by then, will we be called the 1 meter dropout podcast or something like that?
50-22.
The 50-22 podcast. But anyway, thank you for everyone, and thank you for listening. Right, we'll be back to chat rugby with you in a bit.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Everyone thinks I had a storybook career, that I just sprang into Disney Channel stardom overnight, made millions, and lived happily ever after. Spoiler alert, I didn't. There were countless failures along the way, and there still are. How I deal with that struggle and how I pivot when failure creeps in is what allows me to keep going, keep learning, and keep striving for balance. The Vulnerable Podcast is an invitation to hang out every week with me, Christy Carlson Romano, as I invite friends, celebrities, and experts for in-depth conversations discussing the good, the complicated, the beauty of being human, and what it means to be vulnerable. Join me every Tuesday as we navigate the ups and downs of my guests' paths to success.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.